The girl, 17-year-old Rachel Trelisa, the former Mary Rachel Arnold, 14-year-old Renee Wilson, and 9-year-old Julie Ann Mosley vanished December 23rd after telling their families they were going shopping. Their abandoned car was found that afternoon in a parking area of Seminary South Shopping Center. The next day, the only major lead in the case developed when a handwritten note was received stating the three had gone to Houston. Police weren't sure if the note had been written freely. It has since been sent to the FBI lab in Washington for analysis. Tuesday, a Justin man found some undergarments near a stream west of Justin, near Texas Highway 157. They were not there Christmas Day. But Renee Wilson's parents examined the clothing and determined it did not belong to the missing girls.
Some of our friends called us this morning and asked me if we'd heard about it on the news, and I told them no. So then we called down here and they told us we could come look at them.
What happened when you looked at the clothing?
They're not Renee's. They're not Julie's, I know. Renee doesn't have anything like that, and they're bigger. And Renee didn't have anything that color of green, like the panties were.
These girls have been missing now for 9 days. What are your feelings at this point?
There's something's happened to them. I know it. It's just not like them. They wouldn't have just run off. Nobody heard nothing from them.
Well, 9 days ago, I thought maybe they had just went somewhere, but now I don't believe they have. I believe they've been picked up by somebody and been helped, and that they've been hurt or something.
You haven't given up hope?
No hope give up. Just want them to come on back home.
Meanwhile, police continue checking every possible lead. A reward fund has been established with the Forest Hills State Bank in an effort to prompt even more information. And the Wilsons say they will turn to a Dallas psychic for help. Mike Miller, Channel 8 News, Fort Worth.
Hello, this is Mark. I write a weekly newspaper column about true crime, unsolved homicides, and the paranormal. You can find links to my social media accounts and columns on my website titled themarkhobb.com. Welcome to the Catch My Killer podcast, and thank you for listening. Before I get into this week's podcast episode, I would like to ask for your help. I'm looking for listeners to help support the podcast by buying me a cup of coffee. If you would like to help support the podcast, I'm asking you to subscribe to my monthly Crime Coffee Club, which is only $5 per month. If you subscribe to my monthly coffee fund, I will share exclusive content with you. To support the podcast, please visit catchmykiller.com and click on the donate link or on the buy me a coffee link. I would also like to give a shout out to Courtney Dugas and April for their donations to the cause. And that's enough of the coffee business. This week's story occurred in Fort Worth, Texas, in 1974. On the morning of December 23rd, 1974, Lisa Renee Wilson, 14, Julie Ann Mosley, 9, and Mary Rachel Trelisa, 17, traveled to the Seminary South Shopping Center in Fort Worth, Texas, to do some Christmas shopping. Lisa and Mary went by their middle names, so to their friends, they were just Rachel and Renee. And Julie was the sister of Renee's boyfriend, Terry Mosley. Rachel and Renee had initially planned to go shopping with Terry, but he had made other plans, so he didn't go. Instead, Julie went along with them. She was able to get permission and was told that she needed to be home by 6 p.m. Renee was excited about attending a Christmas party that evening with Terry, so she had to get home early so that she could get ready to go. At 12 p.m., the girls visited the local Army-Navy surplus store to get some jeans that Renee had on layaway. They then drove to the shopping center and parked near Sears. Witnesses would later claim that they had seen the girls inside the mall throughout the afternoon. However, it's never been confirmed. Keep in mind that this was the 70s. Most young girls had long, straight hair. And since it was Christmas time, the mall was probably full of teenagers that were out of school for Christmas break. So it's possible that witnesses may have seen other girls and mistaken them for the missing trio. Rachel's Oldsmobile was found in the parking lot around 6 p.m. that evening. It was locked, and there was a single present on the backseat floorboard. but there was no trace of the girls or any type of indication that there was a struggle. The Wilsons went to the mall to search for the girls. Renee's mother, Judy Wilson, had each store page for the girls, and she also contacted the local hospitals and the police, while Rusty Arnold and his mother went to the mall looking for the girls. Rusty was Rachel's younger brother. Police initially believed that the three girls had just run away, but their families disagreed, and since authorities believed the girls had run away, they didn't check the car for fingerprints or take the case too seriously. The only actual physical evidence of this case is a letter that was found by Rachel's husband, Tommy, on December 24, 1974. It was in the mailbox from Rachel. It stated, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we just had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week. Car is in Sears upper lot. Love, Rachel." However, no one believed that Rachel actually wrote this letter because it was addressed to Thomas. And everyone that knew her knew that she called her husband Tommy. She did not refer to him as Thomas. And the handwriting looked almost childlike. The letter was eventually tested for DNA, but nothing was found. For many years, no one has known the identity of the person who wrote the letter. But a highly credible handwriting expert has analyzed the letter and said that she believes with 98% certainty that Tommy Trelisa wrote that letter. She even said that she will testify in a court of law that he wrote the letter. Tommy has always denied that he wrote the letter, and he has never wavered from it. When the girls disappeared, Rachel's sister Deborah was living with her and Tommy. Tommy and Deborah had previously been engaged, but the relationship wasn't too serious, and the couple ended up calling off their wedding. Rachel would then eventually begin dating and then marrying Tommy Trelisa when she was 17 years old. The entire case has been a mystery, and there have been accusations that Deborah knows more than what she has said about the case. But Deborah does have the support of many friends and family who think that she had absolutely nothing to do with the missing girls. This case is one of the most intriguing ones I've ever covered for the podcast. For nearly five decades, there have been no sightings or any major breaks in finding out what happened to the missing Fort Worth trio. And now on with the story of the missing Fort Worth trio, as told by Richard Wilson, the father of Renee Wilson, and Kelly Arnold, who is Rachel's cousin. Can you start off by telling me how well you knew your cousins?
They grew up in Fort Worth, and I grew up in Northeast Texas, and I didn't even really know them until I was an adult. Now, I knew of the case growing up because my grandparents had the missing persons poster in their living room, and so I knew about Rachel my whole life. I didn't get into it until 17 to 18 years ago is whenever I really started digging in on it.
Okay, so tell me about Rachel and how you are related to her.
Rachel would be my second cousin. She was my grandfather's niece. She and her older sister and my younger brother all grew up in South Fort Worth. She and Renee, the middle girl that went missing, were friends. Rachel's neighbor was really good friends with Renee's dad. So that's how they knew each other, and they were tight. I don't really know a whole lot about her life growing up. Her dad died 6 months after they disappeared. So my family and her family weren't really close whenever I was growing up. I didn't meet them until as an adult. Now, as far as leading up to what happened, she married really young. She was 16 when she got married to Tommy. She was still a high school student. There is rumors she was pregnant. I don't know if that was true or not. Even my family says we think she might have been pregnant. So it's not verified. She had a little stepson. He was 2 at the time. And from what I was told by her husband, Tommy, she wanted to be a gym teacher. She planned on going to college. So she was dreaming and aspiring of doing more with her life. They had a really nice house, and the car she had at the time was really nice. It was his mother's. His mother had passed away.
Okay, so I have to ask, how do you pronounce Rachel's last name? I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
Trelisa. But he wants to say Trelika, but it's Trelisa. The correct pronunciation. Whenever I first started really getting into it, and I was talking with Rusty, my cousin, I pronounced it Trelika, and he was like, "Okay, Kelly, if you're going to do this, you have to be able to say her name right." Yeah, Trelisa.
So can you tell me why she got married so young? When I first read about this story, I thought it was really unusual that she would get married at 17 and not even have been out of high school yet.
From what I understand, like the early 70s, and especially in the South, that was very common. And I know before that time, like in the South, it was really common for them to get married even younger. That was the thing that women did. You got married, you had kids. I've talked to people who were raised in the North, and they were like, you get your education, then you get married, and then you have kids. Well, in the South, it's like for females, it's the old-time thinking, and I don't even know that's all of why she got married so young. I can tell you, Tommy was well off. Both of his parents had just passed away. He had a nice house, nice car. He was able to provide a nice lifestyle for her. She grew up in South Fort Worth, which was a little rougher. She didn't grow up with a lot of money. Her dad owned a transmission shop, but he wasn't really a great businessman. There was financial problems. Their house was small. So from listening to other people talk and just from the outside looking in, I would say that had some to do with it.
So you're saying that it's possible that she wanted to leave her house and get married because she then had a chance to move out with her husband and have her own place and then also be more financially secure with her husband. And then thinking back about how things were in the 70s, as you had mentioned, it all makes a lot more sense.
It was a total different, a life-changing style of life, because the house that he had at the time, it's still a nice house. Still a very nice neighborhood. It was his parents, and his parents were in their 70s, you know, and they had just passed away. And they were well-to-do. They weren't rich, but they had nice things, and they took care of their things. And it was an opportunity for her to get out of the... I can't say they had nothing, because I see pictures of them back then, and they were all dressed nice. But I know there were financial issues. I don't know if they filed bankruptcy back then, but I know there were tax liens on the business, and at that time, I think Deborah may have been moved out by the time she got married, but there were still four people living in it. It was a tiny house. I would just say there would be better opportunities. Tommy was working for her dad, and Tommy had previously been engaged to Deborah, and I wouldn't think that their home life was like really that great. I know that their dad, Cotton, he had a temper. He could be violent, not to minimize it, but it wasn't maximized either. It wasn't like there are people who have speculated on him. I honestly don't think he had anything to do with it. I've even looked at the option, to be honest, but I really don't. There were never any like charges filed on him. But I have heard stories throughout the family. He could be violent, not like killing somebody violent. I've talked to some people that were her friends that like, oh, well, she took us to go show us her house and this. You know how it is whenever you're young, you're like, oh, I got all this nice stuff. And starting out young, not many people have all that. And she did.
So how many siblings did your cousin have? I think she just had a brother and a sister, right? An older sister and a younger brother. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So I wanted to ask a question about the relationship between Rachel, her sister, and the same guy that both of them were with. So the older sister was engaged to the guy, and then Rachel ended up marrying this guy. Was there any animosity between the sisters?
Deborah claims that it does not. Now, she did tell me that after she and Tommy broke up, Tommy was working with Cotton, her dad. And she said her parents would keep inviting him over to the house. So it sounds like to me that their parents helped push this along, encouraged it. She said she was uncomfortable with that, but she claims later on that she was completely fine with them getting married. I know she attended the wedding. Deborah's always stayed pretty quiet on the whole deal. She won't speak to anyone now.
So tell me about the day that your cousin Rachel and her two friends disappeared. I read that they went out shopping, and then I guess your cousin and her friend, and then the little neighbor across the street wanted to go. She was 9 years old, so she got permission from her mother to go. And then the girls all went to the local mall together after they went to a Army-Navy store for Renee Wilson to get some stuff out of layaway.
Yeah, Julianne was Renee's boyfriend's little sister. And Renee's grandma lived right across the street from the Mosleys. That's how she ended up in that trio. They lived right across the street, and she was bored whenever she's out of school. Can I go? And they're just like, okay, yeah, ask your mom. And they didn't expect Rayanne to say yes. They expected her to say no, which at first she did. And then Julie begged her some more, and just, okay, fine, you can go. Well, putting together a timeline on that day is like trying to take Jell-O and nail it to the wall. It's very difficult. Deborah had Rachel leaving their house at noon, but from Deborah's account, she was asleep when it happened, so just dismiss her time. Renee's grandma had them leaving her house at around noon. Terry has them leaving a little bit earlier, and I think he's probably more correct. My aunt says that Rachel came by and asked her if she wanted to go before going over to get Renee. I do know Renee had permission the night before to go. So they had planned, she and Renee had planned on going. I try and get that timeline straight, and it confuses me badly, but I would guess around between 10 and 11, probably, that Rachel got over to Renee's grandma's house. And she went in and spoke with Renee's grandma. And then evidently they were across the street talking with Julianne's brother and sister and another little neighborhood girl. And I haven't really figured out if that's all of the people that were there or if there were possibly more people there. I've heard different ways. There's nothing really concrete on that. But for sure, Terry, Janet, and Julie. And Rayanne's gone now, and I could ask Terry and see if, but he probably won't remember because he's having a hard time remembering the timeline himself, what time Rayanne got that call from Julie. So anyhow, they left from there, and we know they made it to the Army and Navy store where the jeans were on layaway. That was verified by the police department. That was verified by parents. That was verified by the jeans being in the car. So for a fact, they got there. Renee did change out of the pair of jeans that she had on into one of the new pair of jeans she got from the Army and Navy store. And that pair of jeans was in the bag with the second new pair of jeans. Now, after that, it's up in the air, in my eyes, anyways. Some people say, well, they for sure got to the mall. None of the purchases that were in the car were from the mall. So I don't know how they can say, well, the girls made it back to the car. Or you can verify that the girls are the ones who put the car there in the first place. That's what the police department always says. They get lost on that parking lot and they can't get the girls off of that parking lot. Maybe it's the wrong scene. Now, there were people in the mall who claimed that they saw them. There were two that would have at least known Rachel and Renee. I've never spoke with those two people. I've never heard it come out of their mouth. Yes, I 100% saw them, talk to them, because your eyewitness is your least reliable witness. Especially back then, all the young girls wore their hair long and straight. 16, 14-year-old girls, they all look alike. Like when you get an Amber Alert nowadays and it's a 16-year-old white female. Tell me something more, because that tells me nothing. How many are there? If I heard it directly from a person who knew them, then I would say, okay, yeah, 100% they were there. The car was found there, but have you ever seen the aerial of that mall, like at the parking lot?
Yes, it was a large mall.
It's huge, and it's got that huge road you would have to walk across to get down there to get to the mall. And I drove there. It's high traffic, and it was Christmas, and maybe that's the only place to park.
For this part of the story, I spoke to Richard Wilson, an elderly man who has spent nearly 5 decades trying to find out what happened to his daughter, Renee.
After Renee got old enough, she would spend a lot of time down in her grandmother's house and help her around the house. And she was in the pep squad at high school. During elementary, her principal was my fourth grade math teacher. And she looked out for her little brother real good. Didn't let nobody pick on him.
So you're from Fort Worth, Texas. Is that correct?
Yes. Been here since 1948. We moved here from Mount Pleasant, Texas.
I'd read that you and Renee's mother remained in the same home for many years after your daughter disappeared. Is that correct?
Yeah, the house we were living in, when she disappeared, we stayed there for another 30 years, I guess. And then my wife's ex-mother-in-law was giving my wife stuff and wanted her to go out and buy a new house. And at that time, we moved. But we didn't move but about maybe a mile from where we were living. But it was a much nicer neighborhood.
Now, on the day that Renee disappeared, can you tell me more about that day? Was there anything unusual about it? She just went out with two of her friends and was never seen or heard from again. Does that sound about right?
Yes. They went shopping at Seminary South. She went with Rachel Arnold and Julie Mosley. Julie Mosley lived across the street from her grandmother, and they were real good friends. And she was fairly good friends with Rachel Arnold, which really then it was Rachel Trelisa. She married Tommy Trelisa. And Tommy has given two lie detector tests and passed them both. And there's another one that gave lie detector test, and I really don't know the results of that.
When was the last time that you saw Renee before she disappeared?
The day before. But she spent the night with her grandmother that night, and I had to go to work. But her and her grandmother was real close. I mean, she helped her grandmother do things around the house. She was pretty old, lived by herself. And then she kind of got to be a girlfriend to Terry Mosley, which also lived across the street. And a couple of days after the disappearance, the police detective came to my house and said he had a report that those girls were thrown in a well in Aledo. And he was on his way down there to check the well. I thought, well, I'm going to follow this bird and I'm going to see if I know anybody in the neighborhood. Well, I gave him a couple of minutes as he went up the street. I went across the street and got in my pickup and was going down the street following him. And he drove straight down Hemp Hill Street, went to a Parrish coffee shop, and there ain't no damn well in Parrish coffee shop. I never been in Parrish coffee shop, but I went in it when it was a grocery store. And then he had gall enough to call me and tell me, oh, there ain't nothing to it. And when I would go pay my taxes, I would just cringe because he was going to get some part of it.
So did law enforcement do a thorough investigation, in your opinion? Or do you think it was more of a half-ass investigation?
He decided, well, they're runaways. And at one time, he told us it was about Easter was coming on. And he said, well, we're not working on it now because Easter's coming on. And they're going to show up with the Easter Bunny. And that is what Fort Worth called a detective.
So tell me about the day that Renee disappeared. How did you find out that she was gone? And were you really concerned at the time? Or did you think maybe it was just something that, a situation where she just lost track of time and it was just kind of innocent?
They were still down at the mall because they had Rachel's car. My wife started calling around after 4 o'clock. I didn't get home from work till nearly 5. And she told me, Renee and them ain't got home yet. I said, they're probably down there in that mall goofing around. So we got together and went down there. She went through all of the stores having them paged. And I drove around in the parking lot, sitting around the mall, see if I could see them out there because it was really crowded. And we called everybody. My wife called Tommy at the bowling alley. And she called Rachel's sister, and I guess the Arnolds and the Mosleys. And Debbie Arnold showed up at the mall after 9 o'clock with Tommy. And she's the only Arnold I saw. If there was any of them else down there, I didn't see them. We were right in line with where the car was parked.
When you found out that the girls were gone, what did you think had happened to them? Did you think maybe they ran away, or did you think maybe something else had happened to them?
I really didn't know. I mean, Fort Worth was pretty bad about then. I think it was about halfway considered Little Chicago. There was a whole lot of killings and stuff going on, and you really didn't know what happened to nobody.
I think that this case is probably one of the most disturbing ones that I've ever read about, because these girls have been gone for almost 50 years, and nobody has ever called anything in that's actually made it to law enforcement, or should I say anything beneficial. There's been no sightings. There's been no evidence of anything. It's almost as if these three girls just never existed. I just find that really strange. And also that nobody's ever said anything.
And one girl, a teenager, she's only 9 years old. The little Mosley girl, she was only 9 years old.
Do you think that this was a stranger abduction?
It would have had to been.
I even wonder if they actually even made it to the mall.
Sometimes I think they did, sometimes I think they didn't. But the car was at the mall. There is people that says they saw him at the mall. And from what I heard about the guy that said he saw him, I understood he was pretty reliable.
And from what I understand, there's also a theory about somebody seeing them sitting in the back of a security guard's truck that was at the mall or something along those lines. It had something to do with the security guard being seen with them.
They said they saw him in the security guard pickup. Back then, pickups only had one seat, so that would have put four people in the seat. And there was another security guard that told that.
Now, was that thoroughly investigated?
Yeah. Plus, a private investigator went down there and talked to the guy. He has since moved out of Fort Worth and died. A whole lot of people involved died.
Do you think that there's any possibility that the girls are still alive?
No.
In your opinion, what do you think happened to them?
I think they just got killed somewhere. I mean, Renee was hard-headed and too high-tempered.
Now, let me ask you this. I cannot imagine how you must feel that your daughter has been gone for nearly 50 years and you don't know what happened to her. And you just have nothing for all these years. No sightings, just nothing. What has it been like living like that? Can you tell me about that?
It's just been hell. I mean, there's times I'd like to have got with her, went out shopping, go out to eat, or anything. And my wife died in 15.
Now, do you and your son ever contact the police for updates about the case, or have you long since given up on doing that?
I used to. Well, probably maybe once a year I'll call them, and they'll tell me we're working on it, but that's a damn lie.
So when's the last time that you think they took a serious look at this case?
Many years ago, I imagine. There's somebody else down here doing some DNAs. They solved a case that happened earlier that year. They solved that case. It was Carla Walker. And the guy that killed her is supposed to start going on trial, I think, this week.
Do you think there might be a connection to this killer and whoever took your daughter?
No, I really don't.
Although this happened nearly 50 years ago, I would still guess that there's people alive that know what happened to these three girls. They're just not speaking.
Yeah, there's somebody knows. We'll never know. I got a sister that keeps telling me I need to go get this DNA done. It'll show cousins and everything. If my daughter was still alive and had kids, and then one of them had kid and got this DNA, it would show up.
Or it's possible that the girls' bodies were found, but never identified. If this is the case, then DNA could identify the missing girls. And I'm guessing that there were probably a lot of unidentified bodies spread throughout the country.
There was a lady in California who wrote thousands of letters. We furnished the envelopes and the stamps, and she was a private investigator. And she wrote to, I don't know how many cities in towns wanting to know about the unidentified dead people in it. And the police always sent her a letter back telling about them, if there was any. There's been a lot of people involved.
Has anyone tried to contact you over the years and give you any information about this case?
No.
I'm sure the other two families feel the same way you do, because it's Well, it's been 50 years, and they also don't have any answers.
Well, I talked to the Trelisa's brother every morning.
What's his thoughts about this case?
Well, some days he blames somebody, and the next day he'll blame somebody else. For the police to say, well, Easter's coming on, they'll show up with the Easter Bunny. It's the lowest I've ever heard of a policeman.
That was definitely an insensitive comment. So do you think that you'll ever find out what happened to Renee?
Not really.
I'm really sorry to hear you say that, because I want to see you get answers. I'm sure that you would like listeners to know how the loss of your daughter has affected your life. I'm sure this incident probably had a huge lasting effect on your life, hasn't it?
Yes, I think about it every day.
And the pain that you suffered from the loss of Renee, it never goes away, does it?
No. I would like to find out who and why.
For the conclusion of this story, Kelly Arnold shared her final thoughts with me about her missing cousin and her relationship with Rachel's siblings. Of everything that I've read and reviewed about this case, I think one of the big questions is, did they actually make it to the mall? That's got to be the most important piece that's missing. And there were people who claimed they actually saw the girls at the mall, but none of the people who saw them at the mall actually knew them, so... And all those young girls probably all look alike back in those days with the long hair, and who knows if anybody actually saw the girls. Did they actually get there? Because I know the car was there, but that doesn't mean anything, because it's possible that someone else drove the car to the mall.
There were packages in that car. The only thing that was in that car was in the back seat. There was a gift that was wrapped that came from Renee's grandma's house. Renee had wrapped it earlier that morning. It was for Rachel's little stepson. So that came with her. And they found the Army and Navy stuff, but they did not find any packages from the mall. So who's to say that they ever went into the mall? If you had a stranger abduction at that mall, those girls would be fighting. And somebody would have seen it. Somebody more than, oh, a few days later. Yeah, I saw somebody trying to get a girl into a vehicle and they tell me mind my own business. And I do get that it was the 70s and people minded their own business a little differently than they do these days. I get that. But still at the same time, I think you would have seen them fight if it was a stranger.
Unless he had a gun, but then it would probably take more than one person to abduct all three of these girls. I mean, two teenagers and a kid, the two teenagers could fight and the kid could scream. And it's really crowded because it's right before Christmas. So the girls probably would have been able to draw attention to themselves had it been a stranger.
Or, you know, the young one dart off. Like, them little kids, they run fast.
They're all like that now, these little kids. Yeah, so to me, it seems highly unlikely that they were just abducted by some random stranger. I mean, I'm just reading on Reddit and listening to other people's opinions about this case. I just don't see that many people supporting the idea of a stranger abduction. Most of the opinions that I've read subscribe to whoever took them probably knew them, and it was probably somebody that they trusted, and most likely whatever happened to them happened sometime after they left that Army-Navy store.
It's somebody they knew and trusted, and Fort Worth Police Department will say very few definitive things, but they have said they went with someone they knew or trusted. They're very tight-lipped on this case. Very. Now, they did let John Swain look at their files, and they did let Dan James look at some of their files. I feel like Dan James got the edited version, and I'm not going to say that John Swain didn't get the edited version. Their police department, for goodness sakes. They're not going to just hand it over.
And I also saw that supposedly there was a witness that saw three girls in the back of a police car or a security guard car, one or the other, and somebody in a uniform was speaking to the girls. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
There was a security guard that years later came forward and said that he saw another security guard with three girls in the truck. Or he was over in at the original security guard that saw them. He was a Sears security guard. He wasn't one of the mall security guards. He worked for Sears directly. Hutchins was his name. And then he claims he saw the other security guard in the Sears parking lot with these three girls in his truck at about 11:30 that night. Here's my problem with that. Richard Wilson and his best friend watched that parking lot all night long. If that had occurred, they would have seen it. That's one issue. Other issue is, why did it take until 2001 for that to come out? And he claimed that he contacted Fort Worth Police Department in the beginning, but he previously worked for the police department. So if that didn't get anywhere whenever he called day one, he knew to call back. If you really saw that, and then three girls just go missing, and you've worked in the police department, you jump up and down until they do listen. I don't buy it at all. There was the account of the blue van that came out in 81. Again, why would you wait so late? That man was from Houston, and supposedly he didn't go to the police department. He just went to my aunt's house. And so that story doesn't make any sense to me. Supposedly he never went to the police department. From what I understand, the police have never talked to this person, ever. My aunt's the only one who has ever spoke with him.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on the story about the guy with the blue van? I believe I did see something about that, but I don't recall the details.
One girl was, you know, trying to get away, and he grabbed her to put her back, and that's the one who told the guy asking to mind their own business. That one came out in 81, and why they never went to the police department, why they never came out back in 74, and I have a hard time remembering exactly how last week went. So if it's 7 years later, how do you even know that was the right day? Those calls, big question marks for me. I may be wrong. It could be exactly what happened, but I have huge question marks on it.
Now, how long did it take for the police to really get into this case? When did the family report the girls missing? And then when did the police actually go to the mall and start looking around?
Well, they were reported that night. I believe that Mrs. Wilson started calling at about 6 o'clock, and the police would not look into it until after the mall closed. So she and Richard, Mr. Wilson, those are Renee's parents, both went to the mall with their neighbor and I would say her brother-in-law. I think that's all that went with them. But they went to the mall and Judy was going through the stores, and she would go back and forth to the payphone calling. She called Deborah. She called Tommy. I'm not sure if she called Frances, Rachel's mom, or not. I do know she called Deborah and Tommy. Hey, is Rachel there? Have y'all seen them? We can't find them. And I think it was around 6 o'clock that Richard found Rachel's car. So they continued to look throughout the mall. The police showed up at the mall at 11 o'clock whenever it closed down. And Deborah and Tommy showed up around 11 o'clock at the mall. And they never really looked through the car. He was able to get the car back the very next day. They never fingerprinted the car or anything like that. They listed them as runaways for over 6 months. And after 6 months, they went to homicide. Even months later, Richard has told me stories about the detective coming to his house telling him, hey, I'm just to go over in this place and I'm looking for the girls here. And he said, I got in my car and I followed him, and he went to a cafe. And then I followed him from that cafe, and he went back to the police station, went and looked where he said he was going to look for him. Rayanne's sister has told stories about them telling Rayanne, oh, well, don't worry, they'll show up with the Easter eggs. But I would say John Swain probably pushed for a lot of it, like the searches down in Brazoria County. There were quite a few searches, and Fort Worth Police Department was involved in them. I believe they were probably pushed by John Swain, but they did actually do those searches. So there was one George Hutchins, and I think reading through the articles and stuff, he seemed like he was very adamant about their case. From what I've read, he would work their case whenever he was off. He kept a notebook with him all the time on their case. So, yes, they listed them as runaways for 6 months. I would say that there were some of those who worked for the police department who truly did take to heart their case.
Sometimes I wonder about that. I mean, I know in the 70s it was different than it what happens today. When young people disappeared back in the 70s, I don't think the police took it as serious as they do now. Now they take it very seriously when a kid disappears. But back in the 70s, I think a lot of the times if a kid disappeared, the police would be like, well, he probably just ran away because that's what kids did. They ran away, they hitchhiked, they were hippies, they smoked weed, whatever. That's just how it was.
But at 9 years old, and to leave your vehicle, I mean, why in the world would you leave a vehicle? Why would you leave your new jeans? Renee had cash at her house that she left behind. She would have took that cash with her.
And no teenage girl is going to leave her jeans behind. They were brand new. And I don't care what decade it is, no young girl does that. That's not happening. Wherever they go, they're taking their jeans with them.
I've just paid money for those jeans. I sure ain't leaving them behind. And a 9-year-old, especially 2 days before Christmas, she's not thinking about running away. And Renee was adamant about getting back to this party. And because she was adamant about her mom getting off work early to get her so she could get ready for this party. That's how her mom knew something's wrong. That's how she knew so early on something's wrong, because she's so adamant about Judy getting her early enough for her to go get ready. Like, it was their friend that lived next door to my aunt and uncle. It was their Christmas party. She was very adamant about Judy getting off work in time to come and get her so she could go home and get ready and with her new jeans. And I get the police are not going to look at it that way. With a 9-year-old, just blows my mind. Yeah, I could see the 14 and 17-year-old. I could see that line of thinking easily because I was 14 and 17. I know how stupid we are at that age. But a 9-year-old, 9-year-olds don't even think about that. They don't even know there's really anything outside of home life. They don't know there's a whole world out there to run away to.
That's a valid point. Now, could you tell me more about this John Swain? Because I did read that he had whatever his investigation led to, no one knows, because I guess before he died, his instructions were for his notes to be burned or destroyed. So I don't think anybody really knows about his notes that he took for this particular case. Have you learned anything from his investigation?
Oh, well, I'm so interested in that. It's unreal. Now, he had files and files and files, and I don't know what all he had on the girls. The stuff I've read out of the newspapers, but he had files on big name people. He had dirt on everybody in Fort Worth. I mean, big people. He was not afraid of going and getting it. So he had tons of files, and supposedly he requested for all his files to be burned. I do know that there were other people that he worked with. He was not the only person working in his firm. I really don't quite buy that they got destroyed. I just cannot see his partner letting those files just be destroyed. That's too much information. That's too much money, because information is money, especially in that line of work. It's too much leverage, too much power. His wife and his, I want to say it was his partner. I'd have to go back and read the article again, is who found him dead. And she claims they destroyed the documents, all of their files.
Now, how much work did he do on your cousin's case? And how did he end up getting involved with this case? Who got in touch with him?
Richard Wilson actually paid for him, Renee's dad. A friend of Richard advised him to go to John Swain. Well, he did. And he did a ton of work. He headed up most of those investigations, most of the searches you see, he is who headed them up. He would call counties to Houston and already have things going into play, and then Fort Worth Police Department would have to go work it. He pushed it as far as he could. The one thing that interests me the most on his work is, I can't remember exactly what year it was. I want to say 75, but I may be mistaken. There was a caller, and this caller had information on what happened to the girls and wanted to be sure that he would have immunity Well, John Swain had it set up with the DA's office and the Texas Rangers. And they said, well, as long as they had no actual involvement of the girl's death, we'll offer immunity. That person right there claimed they had information on the girls. They were willing to come forward at that time. So obviously their guilt was getting to them. And I hope that person is still out there. And I hope their conscience speaks to them at some point. I hope it still knocks at them.
So this sounds to me like he wasn't able to obtain an immunity agreement. I'm guessing that maybe he was involved in what happened to the girls. Not as a witness, but personally involved.
They would give immunity as long as they weren't involved in their death. Had it set up to where they would be turned over directly at the DA's office. They wouldn't have to deal with the Texas Rangers or anybody like that. Directly with the DA's office. And this person had been talking with him back and forth, and he had to go to, I think it was like 17 different payphone locations, and then they ended up never meeting with him, never coming forward.
Well, if he was directly involved in the deaths, and then law enforcement said, we're not going to give you anything, well, it sounds to me like then this guy probably decided that he was going to end all talks. I mean, he wasn't getting anything for it, so most likely, whoever this guy was, he was involved in whatever happened to the girls.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me. But it sounds like somebody's conscience was getting to them, and they wanted to come forward. Give them immunity, which at that time, it was a lot fresher than it is now. So I can see why they wouldn't, but still, if you have absolutely nothing on a case, the only solid piece of evidence in this case is that letter. That's why this case is so hard and so frustrating. And it's hard to even tell the story because there's a lot of different versions and a lot of different people with different spins. And you don't know who's telling the truth. You can't nail it against the wall because the only evidence is that letter. That's it. That's the only hard piece of evidence.
Now, when you say the letter, are you referring to the letter that supposedly was written by your cousin?
Yes.
So you know that my next question is going to be, can you tell me more about this letter?
The famous, I know I'm going to catch it, but we just had to get away. What was it? We went to Houston, the cars and Sears upper lot. See you in about a week. Love, Rachel. The phrase, I know I'm going to catch it, has been highly discussed because a lot of people say that's a strange phrase. To me, I've heard it, so I figure something I would say within our family, because I've spoke with people from Fort Worth, people from that time period in Fort Worth, people from here, a lot of different people that find that phrase strange. To me, I know exactly what they're talking about. It's a familiar phrase to me, but I have never thought that Rachel wrote it. Years back, Rusty believed that Deborah wrote it. Well, I've had samples of her handwriting, and I've never believed that Deborah wrote that letter, ever. Now, Tommy's handwriting, there are court documents and stuff, letters that he has wrote, different items, and it is so similar, it is unreal. So eventually, they did three different writing analyses on it, and they said Rachel didn't write it. And I take it they only tested it against Rachel's handwriting, because the only thing they ever said was, well, actually it was inconclusive. But from the sounds of it, they only tested against Rachel's handwriting. They didn't test everybody else in the family's handwriting. But it was sent off for an independent writing analysis with Wendy Carlson, who, I didn't send you her credentials, but I can send you all the cases she's worked. She's done a lot of very impressive work. And that came back that 98% accuracy that Tommy wrote the letter. I've believed it in my heart for years. And whenever I got that confirmation, it was just like my jaw dropped.
I did read that statement from Carlson where she does attest to it, saying that it does look like Rachel's husband's handwriting. Now, did she say that it was his handwriting or it's most likely his handwriting?
It said 98%, and she will testify in court that it is his handwriting. She said with 98% certainty. And if you read that letter that she wrote, how they do it, they say that with an expert eye that 98%, that it, writing analysis are 98% accurate. So for her to get 98% accuracy on doing the writing analysis, it's spot on. I read it earlier trying to keep my brain fresh on it. My examination revealed significant similarities present in the question handwriting when compared to the known Thomas A. Trelisa handwriting and signatures. All tests were done with accepted scientific methodology, techniques, and scientific instruments, which helped to confirm my authorship of the question handwriting. Based on my scientific examination and agreement of the unique identifiable handwriting characteristics and the measurable distinctions in the question handwriting, including but not limited to letter formation, spacing, slant, beginning, connecting, and ending strokes, it is my professional expert opinion that the person who authored the Thomas A. Trelisa handwriting and signatures on the known documents was the same person who wrote the handwriting on the question documents. The handwriting characteristics in the question handwriting conform to the handwriting characteristics in the known Thomas A. Trelisa handwriting and signatures. Therefore, it is my professional expert opinion Thomas A. Trelisa did indeed author the envelope and letter seen on the question documents. I'm willing to testify to this fact in a court of law, and I will provide exhibits to the court to show that my opinion is correct. So
that's damning. Okay, so now that this has been brought to his attention, that this letter was written by him, what did he say when it was presented to him? That a professional had studied his handwriting and concluded that he wrote that letter.
He just denies that he wrote it. He just says he didn't. He still denies it.
Now, where is he at today?
He actually lives in Northeast Texas. I can't think of the little town that he's in now. He was in Galveston for a long time. He's not too far. He's between myself and Fort Worth. So, I mean, he's not too far away. He hasn't ran off anywhere.
When I looked up information about him, I noticed that he hasn't made any public statements about this case. I didn't see anything from him.
Not recently, no. Not recently. There is one Facebook page that's private that his wife and he were speaking in, and I don't know if they still speak in it, but he definitely knows of this analysis because I would tag him in it on my older Facebook account, and it kind of got shut down. I think that's why. I just want to know, why did you write it? Answer that one question.
I'm sure he's not going to say anything.
Yeah. I mean, I can't say you did it, but I can say something. There's something. There's some reason why you would want to throw off the investigation.
You would think that back when this happened, he would be screaming from the rooftops, "What happened to my wife?" He'd be on TV. He'd be in the newspapers. He'd be saying on TV, you know, somebody returned my wife and her friends. But I looked for this type of coverage and I just didn't see anything like that. I didn't really couldn't find anything where he was trying to make a big effort to find out what happened to his wife. I don't think I saw anything.
I've never seen video footage of him. Now, he did add $1,000 to the reward fund in the very beginning. He recanted it within 6 months. He moved within 6 months, sold the house within 6 months. He was remarried within 2 years. There were a couple of news articles that included him in the beginning in the newspaper. I can find two quotes from him because I like to analyze people's words. He just kind of fell off the face of the earth 6 months to a year after it happened. I'm just like, how are you not pushing to find out what happened? And I get not everybody's comfortable doing that, but at least somebody do it. I'm still getting comfortable doing it because whenever I started talking with the media at all was with Rusty, and that was a few years back. And I was very uncomfortable at that time. And he was like, no, you need to do this because we need to have somebody for the next generation that will keep it out there. And he probably regrets that now, but that's okay. I'm going to still keep pushing.
Can you tell me more about your cousins, Rusty and Deborah? I've read that they didn't see eye to eye about what had happened to their sister. I'm sure they both want to know what happened to the missing girls. Are your cousins active and still trying to get these answers? What's the extent of the family's involvement?
At this point, I know the police department will no longer talk with Rusty unless it's something major that comes through. He has really overstepped a lot of bounds whenever it comes to them. Now, Deborah, she really hasn't ever been involved. She's always been tight-lipped, and now it's just they're sewn shut. At one point, it was so bad between the two of them that he had signs put out in people's yards all around Fort Worth telling her to take the lie detector test. He had a letter typed up and signed by all the other family members, the other two girls' family members, telling her, we want you to finish taking the lie detector test, because she walked out. It was terrible. I mean, there were no family get-togethers between them. And they all lived on the same street. The mom, Rusty, and Deborah all lived on the same little street right there. And he wouldn't go to his mom's house. His wife would take his kids to go see his mom. He wouldn't go to any kind of family functions. Nothing. I mean, this was years. After this writing analysis came out, they have become very tight.
So when Dateline did this story about this case a while ago, did it bring Rusty and his sister together? I mean, it was something, an opportunity for them to maybe put some differences aside and kind of work together and tell this story about their sister? Or was it something that maybe kind of pushed them apart? And I guess from what I understand, what you had told me, that Deborah had told you about the story being covered because she didn't talk to her brother. So then you contacted Rusty and told Rusty about the show, or discussed it with Rusty. So tell me about that.
I call him up and I'm like ecstatic, because I'm thinking, okay, this is Dateline. And it was like pulling teeth to get him to do that. And used to, it was him pushing everybody to do the interviews. I would see him push his mom, like she wouldn't want to do the interview. And he's, no, we need to do this. It's for the girls. And he's done a 180 since this writing analysis. I'm not trying to throw stones. We no longer speak because there's been some issues with how he handled some things within our family on this.
It's really unfortunate that you've stopped speaking to your cousin. It just sounds like you both have a difference of opinion on handling the story of your cousin. But it's also possible that he's just beaten down from what has happened to his sister. I mean, put yourself in his shoes. He lost his sister. He loved his sister. And he has struggled because he's gone almost 50 years and he doesn't know what happened to her. And he's never forgotten. He's never gotten it out of his system. It probably eats away at him.
It is a possibility after all these years, he's wore the hell out on it. It's possible, because that's a huge burden to carry. I'll give him this. I don't think that it would have anywhere near the publicity in their case would be anywhere near as out there if it wasn't for him. And right. For so many years, he carried it a lot on his own. I'll say that. But it's hard to tell whenever you haven't walked in those shoes. This letter changed a lot of things. We haven't spoken in a few years. There's really no reason to. We did actually speak one time because they were searching different lakes and stuff. And I said, well, if you're searching in lakes, why don't you look at Eagle Mountain Lake? I told Brenda, this woman who works, I was like, tell him to look at Eagle Mountain Lake. And he messaged me. He's like, why Eagle Mountain Lake? Months back, there was a disturbance up there around the time the girls disappeared. I said, so if you're looking at local lakes, check it out. That's just my suggestion. There was a big disturbance up there, and something to do with a van and something to do with people who were involved with trafficking is a possibility. I'm not dead set on one theory or another. But that writing analysis and watching people's actions over the years, I have a lot of questions in areas, but I don't shut down looking in alternative avenues. I could be dead wrong. In some ways, I hope I am. In some ways, I hope I'm not.
Now, my final question for you would be, if there's anyone out there that's listening to this episode and they have information that can help solve this near 5-decade-old mystery, what would you say to that person or persons?
Contact Fort Worth Police Department. And even if you don't think it's really anything major, just let them know. That way they have somewhere to look. I think they need people to come forward and tell what they know. I personally believe there is somebody out there who knows something, who is possibly afraid for themselves. If they did talk, what would happen to them? And I am positive that the police department would look past things and understand.
And that concludes the story of the missing Fort Worth trio. What happened to these three young girls in 1974? Many of the family members and friends of these girls have since passed away, but surviving family members believe that there are still people out there who know the truth. Richard is elderly and still waits for answers, as do family members of Julie and Rachel. If you know anything about this case, I am pleading with you to contact authorities and provide them with a tip. You can contact the Fort Worth Police Department at 817-877-8345 or the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office at 817-496-9402. And if you are a parent, law enforcement official, friend, or relative seeking justice for an unsolved homicide case, please visit my website and complete the contact form, or contact me through Facebook. Thank you for listening.